more. So it has certainly discouraged women from coming forward in a public life where they could be shoulder to shoulder fighting for the struggle for justice. But here it seems that they are very discouraged because of the culture of impunity and culture of fear.
You're listening to Khurram Pervez on Kashmir Telling the Story. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
As I travel around Kashmir, I see a network of army camps, interrogation centers, bunkers, watchtowers, command posts, and roadblocks. And more than one Kashmiri has told me this place is like a jail.
Yes, people who come from outside, for them this is very unusual, the kind of militarization which you see. I mean, I would tell you that our younger children here, when they go to any other place outside Kashmir, they would, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, the first thing they would tell you about places like Delhi or any other place where they visit, they would tell you, this is beautiful, but there is something missing in the landscape. That's army. It's so much in our minds. The militarization is so deep here so widespread that younger children, when they go outside, they miss them in the sense that they feel that there's something odd in this society. Why do they not have army camps? 3-year-old, 4-year-old babies, when they go to Delhi and other places, they would tell you. They mean so much to us now in a very negative way. But like, for example, these army camps, these bunkers, they have become our landmarks also. If we have to give an address to someone about our office, like, for example, we tell them that you have to come to the city center and there is this bunker, just stop at the bunker. This bunker has become a landmark, unfortunately. I mean, we have become so immune to it that we cannot see them. We don't want to see them, but they are there. And anyone who comes from outside, for them, this is a horrible picture of militarization. Kashmiris who go out, and when they return back, that is when they realize that how bad it is, how it is affecting our psyche, how it is affecting our behaviors. This has affected our behaviors. Our behaviors are changing because of this kind of militarization. Few years back, we were not people who would react violently to incidents. Now we do. This summer, if you see, there are so many instances where children, when they were killed by armed forces, people reacted by burning and setting ablaze the government property.
Summer of 2010.
Yeah, summer of 2010. The army camps, police stations, people who were responsible for killing children there, they were set ablaze. Because this is the height of the frustration amongst the younger people. They cannot take it anymore. They are repeatedly saying to us when we meet people at the grassroots level, they tell us that this is enough. We can't bear any more pain. This is already too much for us. And they are reacting now in a very violent manner as well, setting ablaze, like, for example, they are unarmed protesters. They don't know what they're doing. They set ablaze an army camp. I mean, unimaginable. These army men who there, they have guns and they will fire them. They know that they will get killed, but they feel that they need to do this because otherwise also they'll get killed, otherwise also they'll get humiliated every day. So they don't want to live a life of humiliation every day.
I saw for myself in a village in Baramulla district, an SOG, a Special Operations Group building that had been burned.
Yeah, it was in the Creedy village, the place which you mentioned, where the SOG camp, the Special Operations Group of the JNK police, their camp was set ablaze because they were responsible for shooting directly on the protesters without any provocation, without any warning. They shot directly on the protesters. Two protesters got killed. And then after that, the entire village, the entire locality was angry, and they came out on streets and protested. And the only thing they could imagine doing was setting ablaze this army camp, this SOG camp. That was the only thing they could do. They feel satisfied in a way. Of course, that's unfortunate. They feel satisfied that they have taken the revenge of the killings. that they were not silent. And they feel that at least this time, they, by doing this, they have given an understanding to the government and army that we will not tolerate any killing. So they are giving a very clear-cut signal to the government that you cannot kill us anymore. So we will not let you kill. So by these things, this is an unfortunate way in which we have to make our oppressors believe that we will not tolerate. But that was the motive there. If you talk to the community, that was the motive. They believe that they have to now come out all shedding their fear and scare, and they have to retaliate to any killing. And the only retaliation they can do is come out on the streets in hundreds and confront the army and challenge them to kill them. That's what they do every time now.
And there seems to be a sectarian component to the struggle in Kashmir as well. India is officially a secular state, but as I go around and look at these bunkers and watchtowers and army camps, you know, I see evidence of Hindu religious identity, slogans, iconography, and even temples.
Yeah, wherever you find these camps, which have erupted in last 2 decades, you would find every camp has, every bunker has a new small building there, which is a temple, a Hindu temple. So Indian army has not behaved like a secular army. They are creating more temples, and also the symbols everywhere which are used, like Jai Bhavani, or these are names of gods of Hindus, which normally people here do not identify with, but the Indian army does. And what is the reason? I mean, why would at all the Indian army inscribe these slogans or these religious texts on the walls or create temples? Why would they do it? And people here feel scared of this because they have heard the stories of how settlers started settling in Palestine and how it changed the demography. These are things which scare people. They feel that they can continue fighting the Indian government, and they will, but the government of India is and some Hindutva voices in India are hell-bent on changing the demography of Kashmir. They have been saying it very publicly, the Indian Hindutva groups, that the only solution to Kashmir is change its demography. You need to have more Hindus living there. So these army installations, wherever they are, when they make these bunkers or temples or other places, this is exactly what scares them. They do not see that this army is here to confront the militants, the armed militants. They see them as people who are coming here to occupy their lands. But with occupation, they bring a different culture as well. They bring a different religion as well.
Talk more about the face of the occupation. Who are the military and paramilitary? And have you any contact with them other than at checkpoints? You know, has there been any outreach? Have you talked to them?
The Indian army and the Indian paramilitary groups, they do not believe in dialogue. That's not what they are looking for. They do not look for interactions with people in terms of engagement where people could question them, people could tell them that this is what they are doing wrong. Officially, at the political level, they invite Kashmiris every time for a dialogue, which I told you earlier, that it is organized in such a way that it is an end in itself, the dialogue. It has become an institution in itself for the end in itself. But here on ground, the government of India, its troops present here, do not believe in dialogue. They do not believe in talking to the people and in listening to the grievances of the people where the armed forces commit atrocities. Because for them, every Kashmiri is a liar. For them, every Kashmiri is a propagandist. For them, every Kashmiri is a potential terrorist. I'm not sure whether you've seen in some of the camps, army camps here, they write a slogan saying that respect all and suspect all. I mean, when do you write suspect all? When you do not trust anyone. I mean, that's exactly what they believe here. They do not trust anyone here. For them, every Kashmiri is a potential terrorist and who is against the Indian occupation here. The Indian army, which is present at the local level in different villages here, come from different backgrounds. They are Dalits, they are Southern Indian people, they are people from Nagaland, Manipur, Assam. These are people who are otherwise also oppressed in their own lands, wherever they come from. So these oppressed people come here to oppress the other, I mean Kashmiri. India has been very successful in using, like Kashmiri soldiers are being sent to Nagaland to oppress people there, or Assam or other places, or Chhattisgarh, and they are being sent to this place. So they are successfully carrying forward and religiously carrying forward the British concept of divide and rule. So it's the colonial heritage which they have inherited from the British colonial past. They continue it. They believe that they can carry forward and continue and sustain what the India is today only by divide and rule. And they have till now succeeded.
You suggested one of the reasons that the international community, for want of a better term, is not attracted to the struggle in Kashmir is that this is a majority Muslim area. But I would challenge you on that with the example of Bosnia, which was also a majority Muslim area, which drew a tremendous amount of attention. How do you explain the difference?
Yeah, Bosnia is so close to Europe. I mean, that proximity with Europe actually was the reason for the Europeans to get involved in Bosnia, because it was happening in their backyard. And they didn't want to have any such conflict in their backyard which could affect their lives tomorrow. Kashmir, they feel, is very far from Europe, very far from US, will not have much of an impact on their lives directly. But also the other factor is that India, the image of India is seen as a mystic place by most of the Europeans and Americans. India is seen as a country of Gandhi. India is incredible, what they say. Then also the other thing is that the Western governments feel very close to India. India is their
strategic partner, as Obama has called it.
Yeah, but India, that's what Obama says, strategic partner, but Indians would sell them that they are their natural partners, which is one step higher than a strategic partner. They are getting closer to each other, and that is one of the reasons why American population or European population does not feel connected to Kashmir, because there is official and the corporate interest in India. The corporates are making the efforts to present India's image as a shining India. This shining India, the image is sold to the whole world that India's economy is doing so great. Every year, there are 2,500,000 Indians who die because of hunger. So this is the shining India or incredible India.
Now there are 250,000 Indians?
2,500,000 Indians, which is 7,000 Indians every day die because of hunger. 7,000 Indians die because of hunger every day in India. This is the incredible India. There are 160 districts of India where there's armed conflict going on. This is the incredible India. I mean, we have 700,000 troops present in Kashmir. This is incredible India. This side of India is not presented to the Americans or not presented to the Europeans because of the corporate interests, because of the strategic interests of the governments with India. Because they see India as a partner in this region, as a competitor against China. They want to promote India against China.
What keeps New Delhi here with that huge military force, occupying a population that doesn't want to be occupied? Is it just about power and the exercise of power and sovereignty over another people, or is there some urgent economic interest?
Indians would want Kashmiris to believe the argument which they give every time is that how can you live as a free country? You need India. You need support from India. But I would argue, because it is India which needs Kashmir more than Kashmiris needing India. India says, what will happen to the Muslims of India if Kashmir secedes? There's a huge 15% to 16% population of India which is Muslim. So they feel threatened that they would become insecure in India, and the Hindu groups would backlash and retaliate on the Muslims in India, one. And then the other thing is that the economic potential which Kashmir has, the hydroelectric power which Kashmir produces, almost 80% of our electricity which we produce here goes to India. It's huge electricity, and it almost contributes to 30 to 40% of the electricity for the entire northern India. It would be energy crisis for India, the shining India which is growing, the industrial India which is growing. Their growth would just get directly affected if Kashmir is not part of India, because their energy needs are satisfied by the hydroelectric power which is produced in Kashmir.
And Kashmir is also the source of many great rivers, so you have water resources.
We have water resources in abundance. We have so many glaciers, and also the strategic location of Kashmir. It is a gateway to the entire Central Asia. This gives an advantage to India vis-a-vis Pakistan. So that's the other reason why India wants to keep Kashmir.
How does a resistance movement morally isolate its oppressor?
Well, it's very difficult, and it's something which we have, which we are struggling, which we are trying to do. I think that what we have tried to do is we are highlighting the contradictions of the Indian state, the contradictions in what they say and what they do. We may not have succeeded to a large extent, but we're trying our level best to make people here and internationally aware of the lies which Indian government is engaged in Kashmir, because what it says to us in Kashmir is that you have to be with us no matter what. We will keep you with us. The situation is under control. That's what exactly the Indian Prime Minister said a day before. But internationally it says that it is willing to negotiate. It has offered talks to the people of Kashmir. But locally, it says situation is under control. They'll keep people under control. They will keep on controlling our lives. They will keep on controlling our future. They'll keep on controlling our present. That's what it says to us locally here in Kashmir. But internationally, they would every time tell us that we are ready to talk with Pakistan. We are ready to talk with the Kashmiri leadership. But they are willing to talk with the people of Kashmir only to talk, because talks in itself are an end. They do not want to negotiate. These talks are not meant for negotiations, because one of the conditions from the Kashmiri side is that any talks could begin if India is willing to concede that Kashmir is disputed. At the moment, India does not publicly say that Kashmir is a disputed region. India says very loudly and very clearly, repeatedly, that Kashmir is an integral part of India. Well, they don't really care about Kashmiris. They have been saying Kashmir is integral part, not Kashmiris are integral part. So that's what is their official line so far.
I remember when I first came here in 1966, the first time, and I was surprised. People asked me, did you come from India? Which highlighted to me something that I didn't know, that there's such a strong sense of Kashmiri identity.
Yes. We feel very different. We feel that we, because there have been attempts from India to integrate us very violently with the Indian mainstream, and we have always refused to integrate, whatever it may be. We like to watch Indian cinema. We like to listen to Indian music, but that's it. And we are always very reluctant people when it comes to integration from any side. I mean, it's not only India, even Pakistan. If Pakistan would want to, like, for example, say that Kashmiris and Pakistanis are same because of Islam, we refuse. We refuse to say. We believe very strongly in our Kashmiri identity as well. We are Muslims. We are proud of being Muslims. But that's not who we only are. We are Muslims, but we are also Kashmiris. And we are very careful in being clubbed with Indian identity, or we every time refuse when I'm traveling outside. I mean, I have to carry an Indian passport, but whenever I'm asked where I'm from, I tell them I'm from Kashmir. I'm a Kashmiri national. So that's very close to our hearts.
One of the issues that is often brought up to discredit the resistance movement in Kashmir is the treatment of Kashmiri pundits, that is, Kashmiri Hindus who have left the state and have moved elsewhere. Numbers of them were killed, their homes, they lost their homes.
Yeah, the Kashmiri Pandit minority, which left in 1990, this is a very important topic for the Indian government to every time use against. It is a whip which is being used against the people of Kashmir. The number of Kashmiri Pandits who have been killed since 1989 till date, the official figures for them are around 209 people, and they call it a genocide. Of course, which is also condemnable and bad. These killings should not have happened at the first place at all.
So you unequivocally condemn the killing of...
All killings of political activists, all killings of minority groups are, of course, condemned, and we believe that they should stop even now. We condemn that, but it would be wrong to say that anyone was killed here, or majority was killed here, or people were killed here for religious affiliations. People were killed here for political affiliations, which is still bad. But then the international campaign, the malafide campaign against Kashmiris, is that Kashmiris were engaged in ethnic cleansing of Kashmiri Pandits, and they carried a genocide against Kashmiri Pandits. They call the murder of these 209 people, which is very unfortunate and a very big blot on the secular and pluralistic values which Kashmiris have been always professing. For us, it's very bad. It's a blot. But then they were killed because they were, most of them. There might be some killings which, of course, were also communal. But there are most number of people who were killed in the initial 90s who were killed for political reasons. We have condemned them all along, always, because we do not believe that civilian political workers can be killed, even if they are working for our occupation. They cannot be killed, and their lives should be protected. So there's no scope for communal killings, of course, in our understanding. And there's abhorrence here in our society today. The society does not like killing of political activists also.
If you close your eyes for a moment, think what an independent Kashmir would look like.
I believe the struggle for our group, people like us, would not end with the independence of Kashmir from India. I believe that our struggle would carry on, because many other places also, human rights groups have been fighting for truth and justice, and not necessarily for territorial independence and other things. We believe that people who are fighting today, who are leading or spearheading the movement against India, might turn out to be monsters tomorrow, because they have been fighting monsters, and it happens. We are trying our level best so that these people do not turn monsters tomorrow. They are not monsters. We don't want them to be monsters tomorrow, but we are not sure. We will have a tough time even after independence, making Kashmir a place, a better place, a place of justice, a place of nonviolence, a place which has no army, a place which has no weapons, a place which is full of freedom and justice for its people, a nation which does not exploit its own people, like it is happening in many, many other countries. The states are created to exploit the people in a more sophisticated way. Every state is sophisticatedly or unsophisticatedly exploiting its own people. Crimes which have been perpetrated on the people of Kashmir, in each and every crime, the perpetrators have to be punished. There cannot be any other redressal. There cannot be reconciliation based on forgiveness, based on forgetfulness. We believe forgetfulness would be another crime committed by Kashmiris on themselves if they forget what has happened to them by the Indian troops. We do not want our state to be an oppressor, because it would be a nightmare for us if we replace the Indian rule by a bad Kashmir rule on Kashmiri people. It would be very unfortunate, and we don't want that to happen here in Kashmir. And that's why we are striving hard to promote the values of international humanitarian law, to promote the values of nonviolence, truth, justice, and democracy. And we are hopeful that Kashmir will be far more different and better than many other existing nations in the world.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Khurram Pervez on Kashmir Telling the Story. I talked with him in Srinagar, Kashmir, in February 2011. Khurram Pervez, a noted human rights activist, has been imprisoned by the Modi regime since 2021. For more information about Kashmir, contact standwithkashmir.org. That's standwithkashmir.org. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Khurram Parvez on Kashmir, Telling the Story, and for Arundhati Roy's book, Azadi, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or order online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, I'll keep listening.
From coast to coast.